Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. This podcast is going to be a little bit different than a lot of them. It was prompted by an interview that John DeLynn did with Adam Miller recently. If anybody's been listening to my podcast, you'll hear me throw these little Adam Miller things that have been running around my brain for a while. His book, Letters to Young Mormon, has kind of been my tucked in my valise at church book. And when I find myself unable to really concentrate or something, I'll pull it out and just a couple of sentences will probably get me going and feed me a little bit. So he's kind of been a dialogue partner in my own head for a long time. And in combination from John's interview, from the book, and then my longtime friendship with Stephen Carter, who's now the editor of Sunstone, we'll have him introduce himself again here, I just was fascinated by the use that both of them make of the term and the concept of stories and the important role that stories play in our lives, how we basically don't have any experiences that aren't, you know, kind of getting interpreted already because of one story or another. And they both are very open and forthright about the importance of having an ongoing dynamic between the story that we're living out of and yet what life seems to be throwing at us, these little moments that say, man, pay attention to me, and that we might be tempted to say, well, that doesn't really fit with the ideal story or the things I want or whatever. And so they're both really good at just kind of reflecting on this dance between our lived experience and the stories that we tell about our experiences, the stories that express what we hope and desire our experiences to be like, and just all that. So this is, in some ways, is going to be kind of a meta discussion, M-E-T-A, just sort of a in between, on the side kind of reflection about the importance of stories and how they play out in our lives in fascinating ways. So, Stephen, I'm going to have you introduce yourself first because you've been on the show quite a few times. And among the different things that you tell about yourself, I definitely want to hear what your doctorate is in, because I think it's a fascinating thing. And just from our friendship over the last 10 years, you've mined a lot of things that you learned there. So I want to at least kind of hit people up here at first with a little bit of about what you studied.
I'm Stephen Carter, and as you said, I'm the editor at Sunstone Magazine. I have been for 6 years now. I got an MFA in fiction, and that led me to getting a PhD in narrative studies and cross-cultural education. And what this basically means is that I studied the way that teachers told stories, which was really interesting because what I found out was that, oh, I'm going to ruin everything that I'm going to say if I go too far into this.
Okay, well, we'll have you going pretty soon. So, yeah, well, just tell us that you studied up there in Alaska, and it was among Native tribes and things like that.
Yeah, I spent a great deal of time working with teachers who were teaching in Alaska Native villages. It was really an interesting setup because most of the teachers who were teaching up there graduate from college, usually in the lower 48, and they came up to Alaska kind of as an adventure to come up and say, wow, my first job is, you know, in the barren tundra. And what they didn't realize was that they were going into a completely different culture. It was kind of an aboriginal culture. It was a first people's culture, and they went through significant shock that really upended them, their sense of self, their sense of what education is. And so what I did was I collected their writings, and the stories that they told to see how those stories changed from when they were first being told until, you know, months or years later, and saw how those stories evolved. And it produced some really interesting findings, and we'll probably talk about those things later.
And then one of the reason that, you know, I kind of recruited you to succeed me at Sunstone, partly because you kept writing these wonderful essays for the Eugene England Personal Essay Contest and winning, or at least placing, and I was publishing them, and I just had noticed that there was such a real openness as you kind of negotiated, okay, I'm Mormon, and I know there's a Mormon narrative or several Mormon narratives and sort of narrative tracks that, you know, that Mormon kind of puts forth as ideal or as the way, and how your life kept sort of not matching up with that, and so you were constantly searching for stories and stuff too. So that's some areas that I really want you to push in.
Oh yeah,
too as well.
We'll talk about that.
Awesome, Adam Miller, welcome to the show. First time on Mormon Matters. You and I have known each other for years through the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology, and I love Rube Goldberg machines. And now this Letters to a Young Mormon, like I said, is kind of my companion the last few months at church, and as well as, you know, just my thorough read through it to begin with. But welcome to the show. Would you tell everybody a little bit about what you do, and just any kind of framing of, you know, I'll have you guys tell the stories of your interest in the term story or the concept of stories a little bit later, but just anything that sort of maybe hits upon, you know, why you're alerted to this.
Well, thanks, Dan, for having me on, and it's good to meet you, Stephen. I'm a professor of philosophy at a small school, a community college in the suburbs of Dallas, Texas. I did my master's and PhD in philosophy at Villanova, and my bachelor's degree at BYU in comparative literature. My wife and I, we have three kids. My wife's a biology professor here at the college. I've published 5 books. 2 of them, you just mentioned the deal especially with Mormon topics, the Letters to a Young Mormon and Rube Goldberg Machines, Essays in Mormon Theology.
And then you've got, what, Speculative Grace, Imminent Grace, I know those two, and they're kind of more philosophical, but...
Yeah, and then there are a couple others that are, like Speculative Grace, are books aimed at a professional academic audience of fellow philosophers, and don't deal specifically with Mormon topics. I would say the theme that interests me most throughout all of my work is the theme of grace. And it's been in my work on grace that the topic of stories has come up over and over again.
Okay, and we'll reserve a little more reflection on that statement as we go.
Sure.
Okay. Anything else to kind of share? Just now, let's just stop there. But it did remind me, Stephen, you've written a couple of books, some fiction, as well as at least one collection of your personal essays, right?
It's true. My writing career started off when I was in grad school, and we started the Sugar Beet, which was sort of a Mormon onion that
started
a long time ago. And we published a collection of those that kind of turned into a regional bestseller. This was back when people bought books. and then you're right. Later, I collected a lot of the essays that I published with you into a book called What of the Night. And actually, one of those essays was listed in the Best Spiritual Writing of 2006, which was pretty cool.
Neat.
And I also wrote a book of young adult horror called The Hand of Glory. And I also write Book of Mormon comic books, which thoroughly enjoy.
Yeah, so the eye plates, right, is what you're calling them.
Yeah, the eye plates.
Second volume's under production right now.
It is, and it's awesome.
Very cool. Congratulations on those. All right, guys, well, let's just dive in. I threw to you guys in a thing that, you know, my own interest in stories, just as a concept, and just, you know, again, you kind of grow up and everyone kind of, you know, picks up the idea, oh yeah, we all look at the world through certain lenses, you know, and in some ways we're quite, you know, it's like when I wear my glasses, I'm most of the time quite unaware that I'm looking through lenses. And so, you know, I had that, but then during my master's thesis, especially as I studied myth and ritual, I wrote my my master's thesis on theories of why participating in ritual often has the effect of people feeling empowered and more centered and more oriented in life and things like that. And so I kind of explored that. But it was all during this myth and ritual stuff that just the concept of stories began to just really hit me hard. And I got fascinated with shamans. And I got, you know, the idea of a shaman who enters into an altered state of consciousness through various means and sort of travels in the chaotic energies, the primordial soup a little bit, to, you know, where things are less clear, and through this shamanic dive they gain some wisdom or some insight about the trouble that's afflicting the tribe or the sickness that's upon the person or whatever. And then they come back, and you know, the way that they would often express the teachings or the insights would be through their culture's stories, by adding, you know, new twists and things. And so I began to really get a sense of how stories can evolve and change and do kinds of, you know, natural changes that sort of have to now meet the new realities. There's a famous story of, I can't remember exactly how to pronounce it, but Jonathan Z. Smith talks about the cargo cults, the people that were kind of in these trading routes when 19th, you know, in the 18th and 19th century, when sailors would travel along and they would stop, and all of a sudden these manufactured goods would come into these primitive societies. And so it was very interesting how all of a sudden the creation myths about the primordial parents of the race, this woman, Hanawuli or something like that, she was called Yam Woman, and her, you know, all of a sudden now into this story that was clearly, you know, ancient and mythic and agrarian, all of a sudden you have manufactured goods, you know, showing up, because there had to be a place within the culture stories to meet the new reality of what these changes meant for them. So I just began to be very, very interested in, and Wittgenstein, the philosopher, you know, his statement that basically all the seeing we do is quote unquote seeing as, that there's always a level of interpretation that we put upon our experiences. We can't experience without interpreting it. And that's where, Adam, a lot of your stuff where you talk about meditative and contemplative practices and things like that, that's to me the secret of what those are all about. It's that attempt to honor these things as stories, as, you know, things that we put on things, and to sort of try to step back then and at least reflect upon that that's going on. I've been fascinated with the dynamic of stories that grow. And one of the things I'm going to want to talk about a little bit later is, for some people, when we grow up with a story, and then that story seems to change through life throwing questions at us, some people see it as a weakness to all of a sudden change our story in order to make it fit the new reality, instead of just like a complete break with old stories. You know, it's, you know, and in this case, of course, I'm thinking of the church isn't exactly what it says it was, and you guys who, you know, have, you know, tweaked it or something like that, you're doing mental gymnastics, you're doing, you know, this work that is trying to save, you know, the unsavable and things like this. And I just kind of want to make a much more naturalistic and important why this is what life's all about. It's this dynamic between, you know, experiencing things new in the story, and that it isn't kind of a negative thing to be doing it. So if that's a tease for partly why I wanted to have this conversation, I'm going to throw that out there. But I promise you guys that I just kind of serve it up to you first, for your first go around, as to just, when did the concept of story and life in relationship to story and the back and forth of it really kind of come up for you? And what are some kind of initial things that interested you and that you're interested in kind of laying out there for us now? So, Stephen, if I can just start with you to tell a little bit more of that journey of yours with this question.
All right, sure. I first started noticing the way stories work in life when I was just starting into my graduate work and in my MFA program. Even though I was getting an MFA in fiction, for some reason I was drawn to write these personal essays about my Mormon experience, probably because I had sort of removed myself from the Mormon context. I had been living in Utah County for pretty much my entire life up until then, and so I finally kind of had some breathing room in this sort of alien Arctic landscape where I could start sort of thinking more about what was actually going on inside my head. And so as I was writing these essays, I noticed myself sort of in Martin Luther's words, sort of falling off one side of the horse and then falling off the other side. So, for example, I started writing an essay about going on a fishing trip in Cub Scouts, and I would start writing it, and I felt a pull toward writing, I guess, what we would call a faithful essay, where I would use my story to bring us to sort of a predetermined moral, a predetermined conclusion. But as I was going down that, I'm like, man, this is boring. This is dull, and this isn't really getting at what it is that I'm trying to get out of this writing. And so I started wrangling the story or wrenching the story the other way, and started sort of using it as kind of a condemnation of some of the vapidity of Mormon culture, and I started looking at that, and I realized that it was just as dull and just as predictable as my first attempt had been, and this really bothered me. I felt trapped. I felt like there were kind of like two forces that were vying for my writing, that were vying for my thoughts, and neither one of them was completely willing to sort of express or reveal itself. They just wanted me to sort of be their story. So one author that I really like is named Terry Pratchett. He's sort of a writer of humorous fantasy. And in one of his books called Witches Abroad, it starts with this really compelling few sentences. I'll read them to you here real quick. He writes, "People think that stories are shaped by people. In fact, it's the other way around. Stories exist independently of their players. Stories, great flapping ribbons of shaped space-time, have been blowing and uncoiling around the universe since the beginning of time. Stories etch grooves deep enough for people to follow in the same way that water follows certain paths down a mountainside. And every time fresh actors tread the path of the story, the groove runs deeper. So 1,000 heroes have stolen fire from the gods. 1,000 wolves have eaten grandmother. 1,000 princesses have been kissed. 1,000,000 unknowing actors have moved, unknowing, through the pathways of story. Stories don't care who takes part in them. All that matters is that the story gets told, that the story repeats." So when I came across these lines, I started to realize what was going on. I realized that there were stories that were trying to tell me. This may sound kind of batty, as if I sort of like believe that stories are actual beings that actually sort of eat people, but I swear this is sort of a metaphor. Yeah. But I understood that was kind of what was going on with me. I was trying to tell a story that was my own, but didn't have enough skill, hadn't thought about how I expressed myself or what my context was enough to be able to actually kind of start my own little rivulet off of the main stories that could eventually turn into my own creek and maybe even my own stream of story. But that kind of became the goal of my MFA time, was to extricate myself from these stories that wanted to tell me, to see if I could develop anything like my own story, one that I was telling instead of being told by a story.
But in this case, it is the story of your life, so you still wanted to say, what are my experiences that are separate from the story that is telling me, which are the important experiences, the not important experiences, something like that? Is that accurate?
Well, see, the interesting thing is that it's absolutely true that everybody has different experiences in life. Everybody comes in with different chemistry in their brains, different, you know, the lottery of how our brains and our bodies get put together, and our context, all affects the experiences we have. And then the fascinating thing is how those experiences get shaped by what stories we tell about those experiences. So a story can come in and completely shape an experience in different ways depending on how a person decides to tell the story. That's what I was feeling when I was writing those things. So, for example, if you had some experiences or an experience that was difficult for you, that didn't quite fit into what you felt like life should be giving you or a result you should have gotten out of a particular effort, at first you're confused and you're trying to figure out what's going on, and it's kind of destabilizing. There isn't an overall narrative arc to help you feel grounded or like your experience has meaning. And this is very difficult for humans, especially humans raised in a very narrative-rich context, which Mormonism is. So what you usually try to do is unconsciously find a story that will make sense of your experience. And so, for example, if you were a Mormon and you went through a difficult time that seemed to go against everything that you thought should be happening, if you used a testimony meeting story form to start thinking about your story, that testimony form will start to shape the way that you perceive your story. Whereas, if you started thinking of it in the story form of what you would tell your buddies at the gym, it would take on a different shape. You would emphasize different things. You would come to different conclusions. And what you see happening there is the story forming your experience rather than you making something new out of your experience. So you are constantly having these experiences that nobody's ever had before in a combination that nobody's ever had before. And our first instinct is to hand these experiences off to a story form so that the story tells us instead of us making something new out of what we've experienced. And I understand why we do that. It's because it's a lot of work to sort of put together your own story. I spent years and a lot of emotional energy trying to figure out how to do this, and it was difficult. So I understand why we do it.
Good. Now you and I had a phone conversation when I was inviting you to be on air, and so I think you're kind of getting into one of my favorite areas of yours. So do you mind me taking you there now? And it's you were on a panel at Sunstone, and I think I've even mentioned this on the show before. And it was a people about writing personal memoir. Or, you know, how do you write from the personal voice and tell your story? And you really made a big deal about the rawness of experiences. So in other words, here's an experience that's happened to you, and it seems like it's pivotal enough that, you know, you want to share something about it. But in the experience itself, you don't know fully what's there, or it's so overwhelming and it's so big and convoluted. It's almost like this one big bundle of experience that happens to you all at once. And then you began to talk about how somewhat within the next few hours or something, you might call your best friend or your whatever and just say, man, I am just like freaking out, man. I've got these cool things going on in my head. I don't know what they all mean. I think there's this, and you might begin to share this element, that element, that element a little bit with them. Well, another week goes by and you continue to share with other people or something like that. And then perhaps, like you mentioned, fast and testimony meeting here or testimony form. Let's say that that was an experience you got up and shared the next time on the fast and testimony around there. By then you will have, you know, structured that story into a form that's not only appropriate for the Mormon audience, but in some ways, the act of telling it, you've also separated yourself further and further from the rawness of the experience with all of its possibilities, all this richness that it could go all these different ways. And so we put it there. And so you just hinted at that's good in some ways because we need to be able to talk about it to other people and at least give them the gist of it. But in some ways it can also harm us because we then now have tamed that story, or it's now got a form that says, yeah, I remember that day when I was like, you know, feeling this amazing, overwhelming insight, and, you know, and this is what it meant. instead of constantly going back and saying, I want to mine that story again. I want to, you know, so I just love that dynamic. So I think you were starting to talk about there. Will you flesh that out for me, this dynamic of, you know, the rawness of experience and stories that both aid as well as hinder?
Well, I think Adam talked about that very well in his letters to a young Mormon. So I'll be brief because I'd be interested in his view on this. But you're you also summarized that really well. You're right that we have these experiences, and as we tell the stories, as we sort of patch together the stories of them, we do get more and more separated from the actual event. And its power, and eventually they sort of get sort of moral driven.
Yes, nice.
And so this is actually one of the things that I saw happening with the teachers that I studied when they were first in the milieu of this native village that was like 300 miles away from anywhere that could possibly be called, you know, civilization, in this completely new culture, they had no idea how to say anything of what was going on, except to express this frustration and this emotional anguish. But usually, by the time the year ended, the stories that they were telling were always like, "Well, I learned the importance of this through this experience," and suddenly, all of the rawness and the energy of the actual experience got turned into morals, and that was the way that they perceived their past. And so the interesting thing is, stories can help you when you're putting together sort of your worldview, learning how to adapt to your surroundings. You put together these stories that sort of embed your knowledge. And you can navigate your way through life using these stories that you put together from your experience. However, the other thing that having a story that completely defines your past experiences can do is that they can also imprison you. We all know people who, usually older people who tell the same stories over and over and over again about this slight or that awful thing that happened or things, and you can tell that they've never revisited that experience or reconsidered what they say that they learned from that time, and you can see that they're sort of trapped in this small little world, and since they figured something out that was helpful then, they haven't moved on from there, and they're kind of imprisoned in there. And I find that happens to me. So you can eventually find yourself sort of imprisoned in these stories that once helped. It kind of reminds me of that old proverb about how once you've reached the shore on your raft, it doesn't make much sense to continue carrying your raft around.
Right.
And that's a lot what stories are like. They can be helpful for particular times, but at other times they may just be a burden. It may be time to set that story down. And the difficult thing is to figure out when that time is, especially, it seems to me, in the Mormon context. And we're going to talk more about this, but being able to use a story as a tool instead of being told by the story and being under the mercy of the story is I think, a really important part of becoming a really dynamic Mormon.
Woohoo. Preach it. Man, thank you. Adam, he kind of found things within your book that were specifically about this. Do you mind if we have you reflect on that, and then we'll go back to kind of your journey for first alerting to this or something? Do you mind jumping in with that whole rawness versus getting tamed and being tamed also by your story?
No, well, that's excellent, Stephen. I think that's it's a great description, both of the power and the problem involved with the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves and the world around us. For my part, it's a pretty solid and powerful description of what we mean by sin to say that someone is stuck inside of a story. Someone is stuck inside of a story that starts to function for them as a kind of prison, right? Their story is a kind of prefabricated pattern for how they're going to interact with and respond to the world. And when we get stuck in one of those patterns and can't get out, we just keep repeating the same actions over and over, even if we don't want to repeat them anymore. That's what sin looks like from the inside. That's the kind of description we get from St. Paul in Romans chapter 7, right, where Paul says, I find myself doing things that I don't want to do and not doing the things that I do want to do.
Yep.
You get stuck in those patterns, and the stories have a life of their own.
Yeah, Psalm of Nephi as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but you're doing Paul. I got to throw the Mormon one in there, too.
Yeah, that's excellent. No, Nephi Psalm is excellent on that score as well. Many of the biblical Psalms, I think, are excellent on that score as well. Just one more thing. I think it gives us a bigger picture view of what we're talking about when we're talking about the problem of sin and what it is that Jesus is coming to rescue us from when he comes to rescue us. It's not just the case that sin involves my occasional trespass with respect to a particular law or commandment, but sin has to do with my whole picture of the world and the way that I end up getting stuck in it and misrelating to the world around me as a result of my stories.
Yes, absolutely, and I'll let you go that. Before we leave this rawness of experience versus the taming that happens as we begin to shape, to tell the story of it, and their taming by it, it reminds me so much, it's a metaphor that I use quite often, actually, at church, and it seems to strike a chord with folks, and that's David Stendhal Rost's model of religious experience, that all religions begin with a religious experience that is huge, it's big, it's raw, it's chaotic. And he likens it to, born in the fires of a volcano. Then as time goes on, as it begins to be shared and a religion and forms begin to take place around that raw experience and stories begin to tell, it's more like the molten flow of the lava as it goes down the hill. You can still see the fire in it, but it's definitely starting to solidify and routinize. And I love that guy's quote you did, Stephen. It's sort of grooving itself, it's finding grooves and whatnot. And then eventually, you get down to the bottom of the volcano, and years later, you just have a bunch of igneous rock, and that's what we interact with, and we forget sometimes that there was really fire, there to begin with. And so this dynamic of Stephen's, talking about the rawness of it, and, even in the early days, it still got all these potential lessons to learn, and then we eventually, have tamed it, and we've told the story, and then, like both of you guys are talking about, now we're imprisoned by this story. It's like the igneous rock and things like this, and so that's why the importance, and, why I think I'm a broken record to a lot of people that read me online, or hear the podcast, and that's why let's go back as much as possible and try to get into the fire of experience itself, to sit, like Adam, again, I'm going to prompt you later to do more with meditation and contemplation and what those kinds of things do for us. But it's this idea of stepping out and trying to deliberately say, I am not my story, I am not this thought, this is not me, there's a me that's beyond this, there's things to be learned or whatnot that I haven't already learned before, and you kind of get into that sort of primordial state as much as you can, and where there's lots of possibilities. So I just wanted to throw that out before we do it. But Adam, will you dive in and kind of, when did this start to infiltrate your language? When you're sharing about your Mormonism as well as just life in general, when did story become such an important term?
Let me go back for just a second and say one thing about your excellent lava flow analogy, that, when you get to the bottom and all you've got are, kind of stiff, hard, stale rocks, I think that's, this is exactly why we see Paul saying things like, the fruit of sin is death, because it leads to this state in which you're no longer living and growing and changing. When you get stuck in these stories and you yourself get stuck, and you end up you end up hardening into a particular kind of shape, you begin to feel less alive. And in a very, very real, very palpable, very corporeal way, the fruit of sin, of being stuck in those stories, is a kind of walking death. And I think, you know, we feel that in our experience of the world. We feel that when we get stuck in our stories.
Awesome. Okay. Fantastic.
My interest in stories has to do especially with my own academic background, a lot like Stevens, I think, though maybe with a slightly more philosophical bent. My interest in stories has to do especially with, it grows out of my work in a strand of contemporary philosophy called phenomenology. And phenomenology tries to give an account of what it's like to, of what our experience of the world looks like from the inside out. Right? It tries to give straightforward descriptions of our lived, ongoing experience of the world. And it also grows out, as you've mentioned, it kind of grows out of both my theoretical and practical interest in contemplative practices, both Eastern and Western. I think I would say that the thing that interests me most about about our stories is the relationship between our stories and our desires. I agree with Stephen that our stories, they form for us a kind of set of expectations about the world, that they function as a kind of framework that we use in order to make sense of our experience. They're kind of like, our stories function as kind of like little models of the world, or maybe like little maps that can help us get through the world. Or we could say our stories come as kind of prefabricated responses to the things that we encounter in the world around us. And this has to do with desire, especially because then the shape our desires take, they get the kind of form and direction that they have as a result of the stories that we tell about ourselves and the world around us. So we could say something like, stories are the form that our desires take. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's great. And or the stories that we adopt, or, you know, if we're telling a story within a community, then that clearly is saying that I have a desire to stay engaged with this community. So it's there's lots of subtle layers to what you're just saying.
Yeah, and I think, as Stephen pointed out earlier, one really important thing to recognize about stories is the way that there's always a kind of collective dimension to them. Right? You're never just kind of alone inside your own head with your stories, but these stories are always coming, at least in part, from someplace else, right? Such that they pass through you, they overwrite parts of you, they change you, they have kind of directions and vectors of their own, such that you maybe end up with all different kinds of desires that weren't originally yours, but get borrowed or imprinted on you from the world around you.
And it's most often not really consciously chosen. It's more subconscious, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would say rarely is it the case that we in any kind of straightforward way choose what it is we find desirable or want in the world, or choose the shape our desires take. That kind of thing, the kind of formation of those desires, happens in a really fundamental way, I think, very early on in our lives. And it happens especially in terms of our relationship with our parents, with our mother and our father, right? With those people who were there with us early in our experience of the world, who give us our earliest maps, tell us our earliest stories, give us our earliest prefabricated ways of dealing with the world. And as a side note, I think that's why I talk about this some in Rube Goldberg Machines. I think this is why salvation always ends up being a family affair. Because if it's the case that sin has to do with the stories that I'm telling to myself about myself and the way that those stories shape my desires, and the shape those desires take always have to do with my family relationships, especially my earliest ones, then it's genuinely impossible to be saved by yourself. Right? To work through the problem of sin is to work through your relationships with your family, especially your parents and your brothers and sisters.
Wow, that deserves some deep contemplation for sure. Huh, interesting. Go net where you want to go next.
All right, so we have these stories. They kind of give shape to our desires. We have an idea of what we want the world to be like, about what we want ourselves to be like, that I want to be seen as smart, or I want to be seen as successful, or I want to be seen as honest. I want my life to turn out a certain way, to tell a certain kind of story about me. We spend a lot of time trying to get the world to conform then to the story that we're trying to tell about it, right? Trying to get the world to conform to the plans that we're making for it. But I wish everyone good luck in their efforts to get that to turn out. There's a great line in the Tao Te Ching I was reading with one of my classes the other day, in which Lao Tzu says, trying to control the world, I see that you won't succeed. And I think he can say that without even knowing who he's talking to, because it's going to be true for everyone that no matter how hard we try to make the world fit our stories for it, it's not going to happen. Our stories are, the world is too big, it's too full, it's too complicated, it's too messy to ever fit inside the little prefabricated shell of any of our stories, no matter how good those stories happen to be.
Yeah, the Tao Te Ching is one of my favorite books as well.
Yeah, it's on my bedside. I read it at least a couple times a year as well.
One of the things that makes it so difficult to see how much stories affect us is because. Well, let me tell you. About 5 months ago, a book came out called The Triple Package. It was by Amy Chua. I don't know how to say her name. And Jed Rubenfeld, who were professors at Harvard. And it talked about why particular groups of people were particularly successful.
And she's the tiger mom,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Person. Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. And they came up with three things. That's why they call it the triple package. And talked about how Mormons were some of the successful people who fit into this triple package. And the first one was that one must have a superiority complex. And the second one was that we needed to have a corresponding insecurity. So Mormons have both of these, a superiority complex and a corresponding insecurity. What does the rest of the world think about me? And what does my ward think about me? What do kind of the general authorities think about the way I live my life? We're constantly wondering, what does this outside perspective think about what I'm doing? Am I living up to what I should be doing? And so this, along with the ability to delay gratification, is kind of what makes people so successful, because we're certain that we should be successful and we really want to be successful so that we can feel good about ourselves. This leads, they're right, to worldly success. And we Mormons are really proud of all of the success stories that we have. We truly do have a number of great politicians, lawyers, business people, all sorts of stuff. Though, interestingly, not a whole bunch in the creative section, which I want to talk about later. So the interesting thing is, this success, I think, kind of makes it especially hard to see how embedded we are in a story and keeps us from actually going in and doing soul work. We kind of get trapped in Weber's Protestant work ethic, that the way that you can tell that you are chosen and by God is by your success. And so if we're successful, if we find that things are going according to plan, then we don't tend to look deeper. We say, hey, the world map was as I thought it was. The story is going according to plan. And we don't look deeper. And so, as in any good story, the thing that sort of catalyzes our willingness to say, well, my gosh, am I really, being successful in sort of a godly way, is to have our view of the world upended, which is how any good story goes. You start with a person who feels like the world is right and that he or she is right, and then they are shown to be wrong and have to change themselves in order to sort of survive. And so this is where I think it gets really interesting. We live in this fascinating period in Mormon history. We have never come across this before. Until now, we've kind of lived in sort of a tribal mindset where having an overall sort of mono story that the entire culture accepts and that everybody lives their life by, and a story that can also work pretty well because this people is kind of cut off from the rest of the world, is going away. It used to work because, you know, we went to Kirtland, and then we went to Nauvoo, and then we went to Salt Lake. We were constantly putting ourselves in situations where our myth, and when I say myth, I mean a story where we embed our knowledge and gives us a way to communicate with each other and a reason to do things. I'm not talking about something that is false. I'm using it in a more academic way. So we've moved ourselves to where this myth can work because everybody buys into it and everybody works according to it. So that worked right up until about the time the internet really got going, when suddenly we had all these other stories come in. And we had to start dealing with the fact that there are millions of people out there who work according to a completely different story, who seem to be living good lives, and who seem to have and who are coming up with insights that resonate with us. They also come up with things that sort of destabilize our own view of the world. If we grew up with sort of a monomyth inside of a tribal mindset, then that's okay if you're in a tribe. That actually works really well. But we're in this sort of interpenetrating culture now, and we have to deal with that. And so Mormons are now in a completely different story atmosphere. We're in a place where people who are brought up in the tribal Mormon mindset suddenly have to deal with the rest of the world, and it really bothers a lot of people. We've seen a whole bunch of people say, oh my gosh, if the church isn't exactly what it says it is, then it can't be anything that it says it is, and I need to go find something new that is true. So the really interesting thing to me about this period with all of these new stories that are all together now is that it's actually, in my mind, a tremendous opportunity for Mormons. Even though it's going to shake us out of a tribal mindset, what it is getting us to actually interact with the deepest roots of Mormonism, which is that all knowledge should come together into Mormonism. We want to find truth wherever it is. We believe that we are constantly being revealed new things. Mormonism is the religion of exploration. We go out and we find stuff and we bring it together. We are sealing all knowledge together, making a great big hole out of it. And suddenly, we have the ability to do this. The difficulty is that first we have to shake ourselves out of this. Only one story can be absolutely all true, when there must be an all true story, when that's not actually Mormonism. Mormonism is go out, find that story. Every time you get stuck inside of a story, break out of it. And so that's kind of what I'm hoping will come out of this sort of internet age thing, is that Mormonism will get into its exploratory roots, and we will become this amazing people known for our synthetic thinking, not meaning our fake thinking, but meaning we go out into the world and we find things that are different, that are difficult to reconcile, that complement each other, and we bring them together in new shapes and patterns, which is kind of, in my view, kind of what God does. That's what we see God do at the beginning of Genesis. God goes out into this chaos and makes something.
That's definitely there. It's definitely part of kind of the part of Mormonism that I love the most. And I think you can articulate that well at church. You know, not very many people will understand you, you know, at any kind of deep level, but a consistent effort, I think we can show people that we inhabit this kind of Mormonism. Yeah.
Right. But that's the reason why Joseph Smith was a religious genius, and why God could work so well through such a strange man was because he had this kind of exploratory synthetic thinking. That's why we can still go back and mine him and mine him and mine him, because that molten was there. He was constantly he didn't let things stagnate, and sometimes that was kind of a bad thing for some things. But
yeah. And so what you're saying as a strength, many people will say, well, he was just gathering things from everybody else. He didn't have any original ideas himself, and he was just co-opting as a, you know, sort of a form for gaining power or whatnot. You know, where you can kind of look at that sort of far-reaching, grab everything and bring it into Mormonism thing as a negative. You see it as a very positive thing.
Well, that's called invention, right?
Yes, right. It's never out of thin air, right? Adam, I want to fold you back in. Is there anything from Stephen's last little rounds that you want to go with, or happy to just have you pick some other aspect of it, or else I've got questions for you too. So whichever you decide.
Well, that's excellent stuff, Stephen. I think, you know, we probably shouldn't be surprised when we go to church and we find a whole building full of people who are stuck in their stories, because, you know, that's what you would expect at church, is a whole building full of people who are sinners, right? And we're all there
nice.
Together, and we're all stuck in our stories. That's what it means to be, at least in part, a human being. And I think Stephen's right too, that there's something especially dangerous about finding yourself. Right, this is Book of Mormon 101, of course, but there's something especially dangerous about finding yourself in a prosperous situation, in which the situation is fits enough with your story about it that you can continue with the fantasy that your story about the world is going to triumph over the world itself. That there's something really very spiritually dangerous about that. I think it's true too that the kind of happiness and success we feel when we occasionally get the world to match up with the story that we're trying to tell about it is, of course, and again, this is Gospel 101, that of course is always the most fragile and conditional and least satisfying kind of happiness and success is possible to have as an individual when you get the world to match up with your story. There's a different kind of joy, a kind of happiness that's not conditional upon getting the world to match up with your story, that I think the gospel is primarily about, and that Jesus is always trying to point us toward instead.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, I'm just, I want to lead a little bit here for a second. Several times you guys have talked about good stories, bad stories, better stories, worse stories, or something like that. And Adam, you kind of take an interesting angle on what makes a story good or bad, that it's not so much content of the story as relationship to it. Or how would you flesh that idea? Because I'd like to, you know, I like the word of thick stories, thin stories, you know, thick religion, thin religion, you know, big, small. Those are kind of my things. Good and bad is a little bit weird, but what makes to you, like you've kind of hinted there, what's the more satisfying type of story? Is it a type of stories, or really just the relationship to stories?
Well, I think we have to take both into account. I think this comes right back to Paul and his basic description of what the gospel of Jesus Christ amounts to. I think it's without a doubt true that some stories are better than other stories to try to live your life by. Not all stories are created equal, and there are some stories that we should try to stamp out of the world and set them aside, and there are other kinds of stories that we should attempt to to valorize and spread and get more people to invest their time and energy in. But I think that the question of having a better or worse story, that's not the fundamental gospel question. And that's not where the problem of sin fundamentally shows itself. Right? The problem of sin isn't fundamentally located at the level of the content of my story. The problem of sin, in a more basic way, happens down in the basement from that, down a level from that, in terms of how I'm relating to my stories, regardless of what their content is. So, for instance, for Paul, it's entirely possible to be someone who successfully keeps the law, right? You can dedicate your life to observing the law and successfully keeping it. It's entirely possible to be that kind of person and be a sinner who will be damned to hell for all eternity because you're relating to the law in a wrong way, right? Maybe you're relating to the law as a way of getting your story to pan out the way that you wanted rather than setting your story aside and submitting your will to God's, right? This is the kind of thing that where Paul talks about using the law as a way to boast and get ahead for yourself rather than admitting that you're a sinner. But for Paul, for Jesus, right, it's also entirely possible for you to be telling a bad version of the story of your life, for you to be failing in all kinds of ways and observing the law, and for you to nonetheless be saved, be redeemed, because your relationship to the content of your story, right, your fundamental relationship to your story has shifted in such a way that you're no longer trapped inside them. Now you can't just give up once this shift in your relationship to your story such that you're no longer trapped inside them. You can't just give up then on the content of your story. The content of your story matters too. But the real action of fundamental conversion, I think, takes place at that lower level in terms of our relationship to the story rather than in terms of the better or worse content of our stories.
Yeah, that's awesome. We did a podcast with Francis Lee Menlove, whose book I helped edit and bring up from Signature last year, you know, The Challenge of Honesty. And we spent some time on one of her essays in there where she's, you know, using other people's scholarship but kind of pulling it together for a Mormon audience, the difference between faith and belief and how beliefs are, you know, content and, you know, specific statements and whatnot of, you know, this is what I mentally assent to, whereas faith is much more of a trust. A basic orientation to the world or to God or whatever that I trust. I feel the universe or God's faithfulness to me. I'm faithful to the goodness of it. I'm, you know, life and whatnot is it. I feel safe within this world. And I think there's at least a little parallel to what you were just talking about there. So Adam, does belief sort of map for you a little bit like what you're talking about, the story of the content of the story, and faith is sort of this deeper, like you said, where Paul and where Christianity and where the action really is, it's more at that fundamental felt level of trust or, you know, just welcome what may life may serve up.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful description. I think when we talk about beliefs, that's the kind of thing that tends to take place at the level of the content of the story. But faith is something that's happening down a level from that, right? It's not totally disconnected from the content of the story, but it's also not the same thing as the content of the story. And it's at the level of faith, not at the level of the content and beliefs that where the religious action is at. I think you're exactly right about that. I think people tend to get, it's easy to get disappointed with religion and critique religion, either from, you know, critique and or defend religion in terms of at the level of content, at the level of beliefs. But I think to the degree that we get stuck there at the level of contents and beliefs, we'll be missing all along, pro and con, we'll be missing all along the real action of a religious life.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's where a lot of people, as they reacted to your chat with John Dillon, it's just like, you know, what is this, what are you talking about here, you know? are the teachings true or not, you know? And it just, like, I'm with you. And, you know, even kind of in the early stuff when you were just reflecting, I don't think religion's about the supernatural as much as it is, you know, our lived experience of engaging with life and whatnot. Most people don't, because what's the first question you say about another religion? Well, what do they believe? You know, instead of like, you know, how do they make life work? You know, that's, you know, what is it that drives these folks at the level of conviction or motivations or something like that? Far more interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if we want to describe religion as the kind of thing that's taking place at the level of belief, then the game is lost before we've even started, right? Nice. Even if the beliefs are accurate, it doesn't matter. Who cares? So what, right? That's, you know, we want to get that part right to the degree that we can, but it's not the thing.
Yeah, it's transformation of life. It's growth. And to me, growth and largeness is basically the sine qua non of those kinds of things. Is, can I handle more experience and be faithful to that experience and still affirm love, compassion, warmth, a desire to make things better? You know, it's all built up into that one little blob of, you know, throw your crap at me, life, you know, tell me everything that's possibly wrong. I can handle it and I can still trust to move forward in positive ways.
I think that's right. There'll be plenty of rocks at church, but religion is not about the rocks. It's about the lava, right? Whenever we try to make religion be primarily about belief, then we've already lost touch with religion altogether, because religion is the lava, not the rocks. You know, the lava will constantly produce these rocks as a kind of byproduct, but religion is not about the rocks. It's about the lava.
Awesome. Stephen, jump in. Anything about good stories, bad stories, relating to stories that, you know, this discussion has prompted in you?
It seems to me like when we're talking about like the church's truth claims and how important those may or may not be in your decision to sort of interact with Mormonism, we need to think about what it is that we mean by truth. I mean, what can truth really constructively mean in our lives? And it seems to me that Alma gives us a really good answer with his metaphor of planting the seed. To me, a story is true when it grows. That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
If I plant a story within myself and I'm nourished and my mind is expanded and my heart grows and the world becomes a larger place and I feel more connected, then this is a true story. If a story makes me larger, as you say, Dan, if it shows me that that the universe is a larger place than I had thought, that there are more possibilities than I had thought, then that is a good story. It's growing me. It's making me into more me. And to me, that's one of the other really interesting things about how Mormonism interacts with this concept of stories. In Carlisle Hunsaker's article in the recent Sunstone, Mormonism and the Tragic Sense of Life, he talks about how one of the really amazing things about Mormonism is how it is the emphasis it puts on your uniqueness. You come in, you have never existed before. When you come into the world, then the more you are you, then the more you add to the universe. The universe is a poorer place if you never understand you, if you never tap down into the roots of yourself. If you are constantly being told by a story, then the world and the universe is a smaller place. And the universe will never be a larger place until you grow. It's all about you, baby.
Nice. Yeah.
I think that's right, that in the end here, the religious measure of a story has to do with life, right? Life and liveliness and being alive and being awake, being plugged in and tuned in and aware and charitable. That's the measure here. And I think we have to be careful too, with respect to our expectations for a story, right? By definition, our stories, they function as a kind of map, a little map of part of the world. But every map, by definition, no matter how accurate it is, will only ever manage to represent one small part of the world that it's mapping.
Right.
And so there's a sense in which every map, by definition, because it's not the world, every map of the world will in some sense or other be a kind of falsification of the parts that it leaves out. So no matter how good or how accurate or helpful one particular map happens to be, its very character as a map rules out the possibility of its being able to cover the scope of the thing that it's trying to connect with.
Yeah, and yet we have rhetoric within Mormonism that says this is the map of all, and in some degree I don't hate that, because it is pointing to, like you said earlier, everything that's virtuous, lovely, or of good report, we're seeking after, that we're folding this. That impulse is there, so I don't hate that rhetoric. It's just the fact that we take that rhetoric and apply it on a smaller scale.
I like to think about it just in anthropological terms. So one of the people in the Alaska indigenous population is called Yupik, and Yupik means the real people. And so they essentially also have this idea that they are the real people, kind of like Mormons have. And so it's just a thing that's part of a tribal view of the world. It's just sort of a remnant. And as we become more cosmopolitan, as we're interacting with the world more, I think that rhetoric will just sort of fall away. It's just, you know, only been, you know, a decade or so that we've even had to start dealing in this context. So I don't think that's going to stick around.
I think it's a mistake too that people often make to try to reduce the church to being just one single story. I mean, that's not my experience with the church. I mean, my experience with the church is that at best, the church is kind of a loose collection of partially overlapping stories. Right. That's not as if the church is reducible in any straightforward way to one single clear through line of a story to which all of its stories neatly conform. The church, like a person, is made up of all kinds of stories that are only partially compatible with one another, and part of living through it and with it is wading through those stories, sorting through those stories, handling the tensions between them. Which ones get more time and attention? Which ones ought to get less time and attention? What's most useful for us here and now to be talking about? Which stories should we just let go altogether? Right, it's not an all or nothing kind of thing. The church is full of stories, and those stories they aren't all the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want us to, you know, spend hours and hours more, even though totally I'm fascinated with you guys, and this has been amazing to me. But let me steer a little bit here. Adam, I've kind of teased a couple times about contemplation, meditation with you, and you've kind of done a little bit here. But there's also an aspect of either Eastern or, you know, there's just those who kind of do these practices kind of are alerted to. And one of the things is, you know, we in the West and we in like Stephen mentioned, this Protestant work ethic, you know, work, 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 strive, 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 set my goal, you know, achieve this because of the world needs to conform to my story or something like that. There's a sense that you have and that you've shared of, man, when you're going after it, you're not going to find it. I guess maybe that's a little bit with the Lao Tzu, Tao Te Ching thing you were talking about, you know, too, is sort of related to it. This idea of, you know, the bluebird of happiness has to come and sit upon your shoulder. If you're looking for it, you're never going to find it or something. Do you mind talking about that in terms of story? How actively should we pursue the changing of our stories or the, you know, the tweaking that has to naturally go on versus how much do we just let it happen and not judge it as it does?
That was an excellent set of 20 or 30 questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's my style, baby.
They were excellent questions. I think it's the case that, you know, the more it's tempting to think that religion is about getting God to intervene in the world on behalf of my story to make the world line up with my story, right? As if religion were a kind of set of best practices for getting God to make your stories come true. But in general, I don't think that's the case, and I don't think religious experience on the ground bears that out. In that kind of framework, if we're thinking about religion in that kind of framework, then our works tend to take center stage as being the crucial thing, right? Because I've got to make it happen. I've got to make the world be the way that my story says that it should be, so that then I can be saved, I can be happy, because salvation looks like the world matching up with my story, right? So work tends to take center stage from that kind of perspective. But I think there's a lot of weaknesses to that perspective, and those weaknesses tend to come into focus when we spend more time thinking about what we mean by grace in the context of the gospel, especially in a kind of Western Christian vernacular, or if we spend time thinking more carefully about what Eastern practices, like Eastern contemplative practices, are trying to show us about the nature of our relationship to the world, I think then the weakness of thinking about the world in terms of works, that'll come into focus then, mm-hmm. too. But there's something that's perpetually going on in our experience of the world as the world tries to give itself to us and in the process refuses to match up with our stories about it. Mm-hmm. Right, that's perpetually on a second by second basis, the world is giving itself to us in a way that refuses to match up neatly with the story we're trying to tell about it. And if we'll set our stories down for a moment and see what it is the world is trying to give, whether it does or doesn't fit with our stories, then a kind of a pre-given, already available and saturating grace can come into view. And that's a kind of grace that you don't have to work for, that God will maybe magically give you at the end of the day to boost you into the celestial kingdom. It's a kind of grace that's here and now and alive and working in your world as the very flow of the lava that is your life, to mix four or five different metaphors there all at once. But I think that's the upshot here is that I think that's the point of contemplative practices, right? That's both in the Western and the Eastern tradition,
right?
The point of a kind of contemplative practice is to sit still long enough to listen carefully enough that something other than your story can show itself to you.
Beautiful. Beautiful. And I didn't mean to interrupt you by saying beautiful. Did you have more in that riff?
No, I was intentionally pausing to get you.
Awesome. Awesome. Stephen, anything about that in terms of, you know, because you're actively thinking about stories all the time as you write stories and create stories and all this stuff, but does that usually yield a good result for you, or what's the proper, you know, the Buddhist, the Eightfold Noble Path? Like, one of them is right effort. So, you know, having the proper, you know, kind of relationship to the pursuit of enlightenment or the pursuit of these things. Where do you come down?
Yeah, the way I would talk about what Adam was just talking about is in terms of what I like to call the second act. In most good stories, you have a first, second, and third act. In the first act, the problem is set up. In the second act, the character wrestles with the problem. And in the third, the problem is resolved somehow or another, except in really good stories where the character undergoes a shift inside him or herself. Those are the great stories. But what Adam is saying reminds me of the way we tend to tell stories, both in the modern, like, Facebook world and in Mormonism. We tend to go straight from the first act to the third act. We say, oh my gosh, there was this problem, and oh, it was terrible, but I solved it, and this is the moral that I got out of it.
Woo-hoo!
Essentially skipping the second act. And, you know, you'll see that on Facebook where all the time. Facebook is the place where you know, three-minute stories with first and third acts run, and we think that that's the way the world works. But the fact is, the world and our lives are constant second acts. We are constantly in the middle of life. We are constantly in this whirlwind, and we're also constantly in this stillness. We are constantly in a place that cannot be nailed down by a moral. It is an organism. It is a flow. It is moving. And we need, in my opinion, to sit in that second act, to experience that second act. And I also believe that we need to give more credence to the second act in the stories we tell. Instead of rushing from the problem to the solution, I think we need to start being more open about, you know, I'm still in the middle of this.
Yeah.
And seeing the riches that the second act has to offer. I find that I often lose my interest in a story once we've entered the third act, because that's when answers start to come.
Yeah.
And it's in the second act where my most productive thoughts come, where the more possibilities open themselves up. And to me, that's kind of my version of what Adam is saying, is stay in the second act and see what it is that it's offering you. Don't rush right to the conclusion. There's nothing at the conclusion. All you're going to have to do is break back out of it again later on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like the image of the first, second, and third. It's not to say that I don't think there's a pre-existence or a post-existence, but it's to say that I doubt that a pre-existence is a first act.
Right.
I think the pre-existence is already a second act, and a post-existence would itself be a second act. That I think Steve was hinting at this too, that right there in a sense there's only second act, right? To be done would be a disaster.
Yeah, it would be boring.
End, to reach the conclusion, that's to get to the end and be done with life, that's called being dead.
Awesome.
And I don't think that's what we want. I don't think that's what we're trying to avoid.
Nice. Yeah, so Stephen's right. In the arts and in storytelling, you generally do get some kind of third act, but it probably, like you said, stay as consciously in the second act as you can. Stephen, is this sort of the opening to where you felt like you said there are Mormon giants everywhere, but there's not too many yet in the arts and the literature? Is that part of the reason?
Yeah, it's partially because of how moral driven our storytelling is. We use storytelling basically to remind everybody of what the rules are. We use it as social glue, and I think as time goes on, we'll start to develop a more robust, more exploratory storytelling. But you know, how long did it take Christianity to develop, you know, Flannery O'Connor? So we'll see what happens.
Right. Now there's been quite a few things over here on this discussion that kind of prepare a little bit for the next podcast that I'm going to do, which is on an explicit, you know, look at James Fowler's Stages of Faith. I bring it up all the time on my podcast. I've talked about it on John DeLenz, but I've never really done it on Mormon Matters. But one of the things that I am alerted to through stages and child development theory and stuff like that is that at some point in people's development, it is sort of important for them to get stories in sort of these clean, you know, here's the moral, here's the, you know, the right way to act. I don't know if, you know, that doesn't, you don't have to stick with that language there. But do you guys have a sense of proper time and place for presenting your second acts versus, you know, going kind of into the well-worn path of third act kind of conclusions when you tell stories, especially to children and perhaps youth? And Adam, with your book, you know, you obviously, your letters to a young Mormon, there is at least some point where you're talking, no, I want to kind of open this up even at that age.
I think that stories are crucial. They're absolutely necessary, that we couldn't get rid of them even if we wanted to.
Right.
And that it's really, really important to tell the best stories that we can in the most faithful way that we can. But I think as important as that is, that still leaves us with the other kind of work that we were talking about, this, what we could describe maybe as a more contemplative, religious kind of work that's concerned not just with the content of the stories that we're telling and how well we're telling them, but that is concerned in a more basic way with our relationship to the stories that we're telling. So I think we have to, get the first part right, but getting the first part right won't help us if we're not getting the second part right too.
So even as you tell a story that's age appropriate or setting appropriate, you would want to consciously always have a sense of this is just a story that's pointing to larger truths that I invite you to explore. Something like that? Would that be a way to phrase it?
Yeah, I think so. There's telling a story well has to do with being tuned in to your context and your audience and what they need and how they need it from you. And delivering it with compassion, I think, always involves our awareness of the limits of the stories that we're telling.
Cool.
Certainly, and also the effect is that storytelling is an act of connection. And if you're not connecting with your audience, then the storytelling is pretty much in vain anyway. It's just you up there trying to look smart. If you're not connecting, if you're not actually with the people that you're telling the story to, then it doesn't really matter. And if you are connecting, then you are giving them something that will grow in them at that time. And one of the interesting things about a lot of the stories that propel religions is that they can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And so, you know, there are people who are propelled by the idea that Noah's Ark was real and that the earth was flooded, absolutely, and that Noah saved all of these animals. And there are other people who are propelled by exploring the metaphorical possibilities and of the story and what it can tell them about their own soul's journey. And so that's actually why a lot of texts survive for such a long time, is because they resonate on so many different levels.
Nice, nice. I want to get into a couple of areas. One is what I hinted at before about the naturalness of the dynamic and the importance of the dynamic of constantly revisiting our story in relationship with reality. And again, I want to cream this mental gymnastics meme that is the plague of, you know, so many of these discussion boards. And I'm not going to try to say that there isn't a lot of people who are approaching story, they're approaching life with their heads. And so that there is some sort of mental act of like, I really want to still have this fit. I want to still have the old surety that I once had in this. And so I'm going to, as an act of will and an act of thinking, I'm going to make this fit. So that does occasionally happen. But it seems like such a broad stroked, easy dismissible, that's just mental gymnastics, versus what I've been always trying to articulate is, no, you sort of live into these new perspectives at such a way that they don't feel so much like they're generated from your head, but they're driven actually by your experiences. To me, of course, among the experiences I have to take seriously are these really expansive spiritual ones where, you know, I just feel something fundamentally different than just emotions or just the sort of pleasure that comes from a neat idea. You know, there's those are kinds of things here. So it's more of a moving and a centering in, and just this dynamic is very, very natural to me, and it's no longer driven so much by intention and my brain and things that would do it. So what do you guys say about this dynamic process, why it's good, why it's to be celebrated that you do not have the same story today that you had yesterday?
Anthropology really helped me out with all of this, as did postmodernism. One of the things that really bothered me when I was going through my faith transition was the idea that, you know, maybe the church wasn't everything it said it was, or the stories weren't all true. But when I studied anthropology and postmodernism, I became convinced that that every culture has its way of constructing the world, and that Mormonism was a culture and was therefore a way of constructing the world. There was pretty much no way to back out of that. And so suddenly, after a lot of thought, after much second act, I sort of understood that this was cool. It stopped bugging me that things weren't true in that sort of objective sense.
Right.
And I started to see that everybody is given tools to be able to create something beautiful. And I started to see religion not as a catalyst for obedience, but as a catalyst for creativity, for creation. To me, God is creation. And we are practicing to become like God, which means we are practicing in creation. And so there is a time, as we know from the Karate Kid, when you need to be obedient.
This is the first time this has been cited upon the Mormon Matters podcast. Go for it. I want to hear it.
There is a time for obedience, as we've learned from the Karate Kid, when we need to paint the house in a particular way in order to prepare ourselves for the conflict. When we need to use everything that we have learned in new and different ways in order to match a fluid situation. So if we see religion not as obedience, but as creation, then suddenly doing mental gymnastics makes perfect sense. Because what we're doing is we're saying, yes, God gave us these fascinating stories for us to mine. God gave us this community in which to learn to interact with each other in compassionate, creative, and hopefully progressing ways. It's our little school where we create. It's not a place for complete obedience. It's a place to be together, to be present, to sometimes hurt each other, sometimes heal each other. And so once I started to understand religion as a place to create, and I think that that is its main function, I think that that is the function that it is best evolved to do, a lot of that of that difficulty fell away for me.
Nice. Adam, how do you approach the idea of mental work versus living into and having this dynamic happen all the time?
Well, let me just note with respect to the Karate Kid that the discipline, as Stephen pointed out, is crucial to the expression of real creativity. You can't skip the obedience. You can't skip the discipline, right? You can't skip the hard work of painting the house without knowing why you're painting the house quite the way you're painting the house.
Why am I doing scales on the piano when I want to be playing concertos?
Exactly. Yeah, but the scales aren't the point. The discipline is not the point, right? Man's not created for the Sabbath. The Sabbath is created for man, right? The point of the rules, of the laws, of the discipline is for the sake of life itself, for the sake of the creativity that's involved in growing and changing and moving. With respect to mental gymnastics, you know, I want to be really aware of and sensitive to the possibility of self-deception, because that possibility runs deep in all of us, all the time. The ways that, even just little tiny, teeny tiny ways all throughout the day, every day, you know, we're telling our stories to ourselves about ourselves in a particular way, partly in order to protect ourselves and partly in order to deceive ourselves. And it's just as easy to use religion as a tool for self-deception as anything else. So I want to be really sensitive to the possibility that I'm wrong. That I'm just kidding myself being engaged in mental gymnastics, etc. That's always a live possibility, and I suspect that to some degree at least, it's also always true.
Right.
To one degree or another.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
But I think it's a mistake to think that, I think it's a mistake to reduce it to that, right? To not see the possibility that there's something bigger going on here, that there's something more substantial apart from the self-deception. Because to not see that there's something bigger going on would itself be a pretty fatal form of self-deception.
Nice.
I think it's a mistake to want the truth to be truth to itself be simple, as if the truth were just one thing. I think the very character of truth is multiple. I think the very nature of the world around us, the mark of the fact that the world around us is real, is that it's messy and plural. And there are all kinds of competing agencies and competing stories and competing interests and opposing vectors. But the very mark of reality is its plurality and multiplicity and messiness. And if we want things to, if we think that the very character of truth is for it to be true and simple, then all we've ended up doing, I think, is choosing our maps over the world. Maps can be simple, but the world isn't. And God wants us to choose the world, not our maps.
Beautiful, beautiful. Can I push you a little bit, not on the content, but Stephen mentioned, you know, through anthropology, through postmodernism, all of a sudden this just became the most natural thing in the world. He didn't worry about it. He enjoyed the dynamic of constantly, you know, having to expand his vision of, you know, X, Y, or Z, you know. And so at what point, Adam, do you remember kind of being in a state where it's like, oh man, I got to rethink God again. I've got to rethink church. I've got to rethink sin. You know, all these things that you've obviously done. When did it become like pleasurable, or is it? I mean, obviously, there's pleasure and pain in what we're talking about here. But when did it become something that like you didn't fight against any longer?
That's a really good question. I mean, when was the last time I felt like that? Was probably this morning.
Yeah. Okay. Nice, nice. But, yeah. There's that. Oh, dang it! You know, here's another thing that I gotta face.
I woke up again this morning, and I'm still in the second act.
Yeah.
Which is good because
there is a wistfulness to that. Yeah.
Hopefully, my wife and kids would be pretty sad if I wasn't still here in the second act. But I think too, part of being a human being is to experience kind of ongoing failure.
Nice.
Especially in our capacity to understand ourselves and the world around us, right? To being constantly, perpetually exposed to our failure to have grasped the world around us or even ourselves or to have responded to the world in a genuinely charitable way. And coming to grips with that doesn't mean that you stop failing or that it stops hurting you or other people. But I think coming to grips with that means changing your relationship to the fact that failure is going to be ongoing, and that it's not all a total loss. That in fact, were things to be otherwise, were the second act to come to an end, were all the conflicts to be finally resolved, that would in some sense be the biggest disaster in the history of the universe.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, we all want to scream, you know, with George Costanza, "Serenity now!" You know, and have right. I'd just be free from all that. But yet we know that that's really not the deep, satisfying peace, you know. It's got to be the peace that's in the midst of the messiness that's like, okay, this is life, and I'm living it. And, yeah, there's sweetness, but there's pain at the same time. But we just can't – there was just these moments. To me, it really was late in my grad school where I just like I quit even having to grieve, you know, the loss of I'm so damn sure I know it all, you know, figuring it out. There was a real moment of grieving that took me quite a few years, but yeah, it just kind of there was a shift that happened within me, and I guess I'm trying to get you guys to tell those stories if it happened with you as well, but it seems to have. Thank you for what you've both shared on that. I've got one more area to go, and then I'll give you guys shots for final thoughts and, you know, pull it back to the higher plane or whatever you guys want to do. This is one that I teased a little bit in my email to you guys, framing this a little bit. That, and here's in some ways where I'm thinking of an audience that's, you know, at different levels of a faith transition or something like that. And one of the things that comes up a lot, and, you know, I face it, you know, when I'm, you know, a priesthood quorum instructor, the high priest quorum right now, when I did it as a gospel doctrine teacher and things like this, I was constantly needing to teach things, or, you know, my calling, you know, said that you should teach this, and you should teach it in a fairly straightforward way, at least, you know, honor the story, honor the good aspects of the story, and tell it to people who believe it maybe at a more literal level than you. So when you guys are in situations where you do understand stories at a different level, or, you know, you're more interested in what they point to rather than the specifics and historicity, or they're literally this or something, how do you approach that, and how do you feel good about sharing, and do you share with sort of a, you know, for those who have ears, let them hear that I'm wrestling with this at a deeper level, or, you know, how do you guys present, you know, stories, myths, you know, in the mythic big sense of not necessarily false, but clearly instructional, but not meant to be taken literally. How do you guys react to that? So I think, Stephen, how about you go first on that, if you're willing?
I actually don't find myself talking about this a lot, especially not in church.
I mean, you don't reflect about the fact of stories or and how they shape, or you just don't find yourself sharing stories that Mormons expect to be, you know, everyone to kind of assent to.
This is one of the few times that I've actually had a conversation about this with other people. Just because it takes usually so much groundwork with people to be able to start sort of even talking about it. So when I come across somebody who seems to be, you know, sort of have the background to think about it, I'm totally willing to talk with them about it. But it seems to me that kind of the most important thing that comes out of this knowledge that I've put together is to be able to sort of back off of it whenever I'm with people and be with people. Because if I'm bringing this knowledge in and sort of making it be the guiding light to every conversation that I have with anybody, then I'm stuck in a story, one that
nice.
I make, right?
Yeah.
and I constantly have to be on the lookout for that. And to me, the best way to break out of a story is to simply look around and say, well, my gosh, what is happening right now? Because inevitably, I will find out that the universe is a bigger place than I had previously thought. That a person that I'm sitting next to has more inside of them than I had previously thought. And I want to break out of those stories and find that new thing to expand a little bit more. And the best way to do that is to simply be with a person. And if, you know, something like this comes up, sure, I'll share it with them. But the whole point is to connect. If I can't do that, then all of this knowledge is kind of in vain. It doesn't do me any good.
Okay, so yeah, you're kind of doing a meta reflection here, and I love that. and I think this idea of being with them and recognize the situation, wanting to be with them. So in some ways, I think that's your sense of saying you're not sending a coded message, you know, behind your telling of the standard myth. So for instance, I guess so what I'm really trying to get though is, are you in a turmoil within your own head or something when you teach? I've been pretty clean on this podcast for, I don't find, you know, I like the story of the war in heaven. you know, as this wonderful, you know, rich thing for wrestling, but I don't believe in Satan. I don't believe in a Lucifer character, you know, as literally happened. I don't necessarily believe in this council in heaven and all that stuff. So, but yet I still teach that, you know, when I'm called upon, when the lesson, you know, I taught lesson 3 in the priesthood manual, the plan of salvation, the relief society manual 2, I guess it is. And, you know, I shared about the war in heaven and stuff like that. I didn't feel a whole lot of conflict within me because, you know, there's several levels at which you could teach that story. So I guess I'm just trying to get a sense for you guys that there's got to be some moments when you're called upon to teach or to share a story that you've deconstructed, that you've, you know, really seen now, as Adam keeps saying, you know, as a map and absolutely not the territory. It isn't the stuff. It's you know, it's pointing towards something larger.
The interesting thing is it doesn't matter so much what story you tell as the rigor and the creativity and the honesty that you bring in your interpretation as you lead the interpretation of the story. For example, when I was in my MFA program, we read this novel called Fermata by Nicholson Baker, and it's a book that I do not want to go back to. I didn't enjoy it at all. But the story, the interpretation, and the time that we had around interpreting it was very instructive and very enlightening. And it seems to me that. It's kind of like the saying, when two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there as well. So sure, we bring these stories that have multiple interpretations, may not be literally true, but you know, who cares? Does it make something grow? If it makes something grow, then that's a true story. And so when I'm in a classroom situation and we're talking about a particular story, the most important thing to me is that we, right there, right then, bring our most honest reflection to bear on it, that we don't get caught up in the story that always wants to take over the conversation.
Nice.
It's the pattern that we've all heard before. We know all the stories that pop off of this particular story. Which pattern are we going to take? And so actually, when I teach lessons, I put in hours of preparation so that I can dodge every one of those stories that wants to take over, so that we can go into a new place where we can make something, because that's what the story is there for. The story is there for us as human beings to make some meaning and to connect with each other. The story is a launching pad.
Yeah, that's a good way to phrase it. Adam, I won't bother to recap my question because it was 9 questions in one, as usual. So just jump in if you would on that basic same area.
Well, I think that's really excellent advice that Stephen gave us about how to approach teaching a class. I think for me, the key thing to say in a slightly different way is, you know, there's a passage in the Doctrine and Covenants that says, you know, you not only have to teach the truth, but you have to teach it by the Spirit of truth. And even if it's the truth, if you don't teach it by the Spirit of truth, it's not of me, because it's teaching it by the Spirit of truth. That's the crucial thing. Mm. Like you could even say the wrong thing, but if you say the wrong thing by way of the Spirit of truth, right, it still counts. It's
nice.
Still the Spirit still bore witness of it, because that's got to be true, because we're always saying wrong things all the time, and the church would be an absolute disaster if we couldn't say wrong things and the spirit still worked through it.
Yeah,
but I think that's another way of saying, as also we see in the Doctrine and Covenants, that you're never supposed to teach anything but repentance. To teach by the Spirit is to teach repentance, and if you're teaching repentance, then you're teaching the gospel. And if you're not teaching repentance, it doesn't matter what you're teaching. You're not teaching the gospel. There's a This reminds me of an early Buddhist sutta that describes a young monk who's taken up the training life, as the Buddha says, right? Who's begun to practice and search for enlightenment, and he's trying to meditate one day, and he keeps having all these questions pop up in his mind about whether the world is eternal or not, or whether the world is infinite or not, or whether there's life after death, or whether whether the soul is separable from the body. And he says, I'm going to go to the Buddha and ask him these questions, and if he can tell me what the answers are, then I'll continue as a disciple. But if he doesn't, then I'm gonna hit the road and try to find someone who can answer the questions for me.
Yeah.
And so he goes to the Buddha and he asks him all these questions about the nature of the world and life after death, etc. And the Buddha says, let me tell you a story. And he tells him this story about a man who was shot with an arrow that was smeared with poison. And the doctor comes to try to remove the arrow from the man before he dies, but the man refuses to let him remove the arrow until he finds out how tall the man was that shot the arrow and what his last name was and what his family background was and what kind of arrow it was and where he got the wood for the arrow, etc. And the Buddha says, those are interesting questions, but the man, before he's ever going to get the answers to them, he's going to die. And right. Then what good would those answers be? And the Buddha says, that's you here, young disciple. You want answers to all these questions that for the moment at least are beside the point. We have to get the arrow out before you're dead. And I think happens a lot in our discussions, especially here at the periphery, right? When we Mormon stories and different kinds of things where we talk about all these different kinds of issues in the church. I think we often get lost in wanting answers to questions that even if we had them, they wouldn't matter, that they wouldn't make a difference, they wouldn't pull the arrow out. When the thing to do, the only responsible thing to ever do, is to always redirect people's attention to getting the arrow out before they're dead.
Yeah, yeah. So you left us hanging a little bit. I mean, you obviously be more explicit, if you would, about to teach repentance, because you've reframed sin, you know, as, you know, not being faithful to life, but and being faithful, you know, to your story and trying to make life fit your story and all that stuff. When you talk about repentance, would you be a little more discursive about that for us?
I think it's what it looks like on the ground is pretty familiar, right? When repentance is taking place as part of a lesson. The way we usually describe it is that people feel the Spirit, right? And what it means to feel the Spirit is that you feel plugged in, right? You feel more plugged in than you did before. You feel, this is the way Parley Pratt describes it, of course, right? That your senses are enlivened, that you see where you are. You, as Stephen put it, right, you actually notice the people that you're with. You're there. You're plugged in. There's Spirit. You feel alive. You feel resurrected to one degree or another. And it's that coming back to ourselves, that return to some kind of presence with one another, that I think is the mark of repentance, and that's what we describe often with the word Spirit. And there's all different kinds of ways to invite the Spirit. I mean, you can think of all the different kinds of people you've had lessons from or heard talks from over the years, and with all different levels of education, with all different kinds of backgrounds. Anybody can invite the Spirit by saying just all kinds of things in all different kinds of ways. It just depends on whether or not it's sparked and Spirit actually begins to flow as a result of the way that they said it.
Yeah, and I'll let people go back to John's interview with you for a little bit more on sin and, you know, repentance not being about breaking commandments and laws and having to be forgiven and, you know, justice being met and all that stuff. And it's more just in both cases for you, it's just, you know, getting in and out of the flow again, you know, a little bit more kind of stuff. And so I like it. I attract it. I really think that's what Paul was after too. We ended up with some lava rocks.
And Jesus too, I think, was after.
Yeah, yeah.
Was after the same kind of thing. And the interview is good, but people can always, of course, buy the book too, which is what I'd recommend.
Oh, well, absolutely. Absolutely too. I was just going to – yes. So this will be buy the book, buy Rube as well. And then, Stephen, you happened to mention Alma 32 and the experiment upon the word and all that stuff. Isn't that another one of your books, Adam? Didn't you do something with Salt Press?
Oh, yeah. I edited a collection of essays about Alma Chapter 32.
Nice, nice. So I'll link to all your books and, Stephen, your books, and we'll make sure that everyone listens. But thank you guys for being on. I want to give you guys a chance to say anything that you left on your tablets and in the conversation, pull out of it. So is there anything, Stephen, left for you?
I think we've basically covered everything that I had in my brain.
Great. Well, thank you, brother. I love having you on, and our friendship over these last 10 years has just been so important to me. You're one of the voices in my head a lot. So, and I'm glad to hopefully put you out there again in front of this audience, and hopefully they can be somebody that you can be somebody for them in the same good, positive way. So thank you.
No problem.
Adam, what's anything that you didn't get to say today that you'd kind of hope to, or something you want to reiterate?
I agree with Steve. I think we did a good job of covering the bases. For me, the reason I feel like it would be dishonest on my part to leave the church, regardless of what other kinds of questions or doubts or reservations I have, is that there's no doubt in my mind that the degree to which I'm awake and alive, and my life is not imprisoned by the stories that I've been trying to tell about it, that's a direct result of my participation in the church and my commitment to it. And I think it can help other people in similar ways. Maybe not everyone, maybe not all the time, maybe not in the way that we'd like, but there's no place else to go, for my part at least. And part of being honest is, and part of being honest with myself is, sticking with the church.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I say stuff like that a lot on this podcast as well. Maybe you know, I think people have listened to me enough to know that it's not an exclusivism, but yet, at least for me, in that when I'm talking in that frame, it's more like, all this did happen for me here. I found the richness here. I found the opportunities through the stories, through the teachings, through the scriptures, through the invitations of, you know, not only explicitly that come over pulpits, but just as the Spirit whispers with me, you know, as I'm serving here and as people, like Stephen just mentioned there, there's so much more to them than, you know, you ever even imagined, you know, the gorgeousness of the people next to you. That happened for me within Mormonism, so I'm always like, and because that's my tradition and I feel called within it, this works for me. And yet I don't, you know, think that, you know, somebody from another religion can't have that within theirs as too. Is that a piece of yours, or is there something special within Mormonism that, you know, you get it gets the job done better or in a unique way for you, Adam?
I'm in pretty basic agreement with what you said, though I don't want to rule out either the possibility that there's something particularly worthy of attention going on here in Mormonism. And as Mormons, it's our responsibility to try to think as clearly and carefully and charitably as we can about what that might be.
Yeah, yeah. That's along, good.
Along those same lines, one of the reasons why I stick with it is because Mormonism, it's kind of like stumbling on a hidden treasure or on a rabbit hole that leads to vast undiscovered countries. The more I look into Mormon theology and culture and doctrine and stuff like that, the more I realize how much there is to create with. It's I have not found the bottom at all. There is so much here, and that just makes me so happy to be able to have like this gigantic sandbox. It was kind of the reason why I liked Alaska so much, was that everything that you did there was being done for the first time. And Mormonism feels like that place to me. I mean, it's a young enough religion with a deep enough mythology that there is almost no limit to all the creation that we can make. And if creation is the point of existence, and I think it is, if connection is the point of existence, I think this is a fabulous place to be. there is so much that you can do for the first time. And, you know, since you're an individual soul, you will always be doing something for the first time. But that's one of the main attractors of Mormonism to me, is that it grows inside of me. It helps me constantly see new things. It always shows me that the universe is bigger than I thought it was. And, you know, what more do you want?
Yeah, and it invites us to be as big as possible, you know, to have as much experience and connect with as much of life and people and other agents who are, you know, wonderful and frustrating. I mean, it's so explicit there that that's where I'm with you, Adam. There might be something going on here with the vision of, you know, us and God on parallel paths and whatnot, that there might be something there. And so James Falconer and I have discussions like this too, because sometimes I just, he says it a little too firmly, but yet you guys are attracting me to, you know, to think in terms of, I know that I'm called to it. But yet to wonder if it's really, it's got something going on that others don't. That's an interesting question for me. So thank you. Gala, guys, I loved that. Did I interrupt either of you with a final thought on this topic of staying Mormonism?
Nope.
Okay, awesome. Well, friends, I just, and this has been among the most fascinating 2 hours of my life. I hope that our listeners, I trust that they will enjoy it. It really was sort of a meta discussion in the sense that we didn't really take a gospel topic or, you know, some kind of thing that's happening recently. But and I just find that this is such a fundamental thing, and the fact that both of you just the word stories jumped out to me all the time when I talk with you about as a way of explaining our lenses and deepening concepts. Thank you for being willing to share. You guys have been very generous.
Thank you, Dan.
Listeners, please come to the website and engage with these guys. You know, comment on Facebook all you want, but it'll last longer if you go to the Mormon Matters website into the comments section and weigh in. And if there's something directly for either of these guys, I'll make sure that they're alerted to questions that you might ask them and hope that they'll have some time to respond. While you're at Mormon Matters, please donate. I appreciate everything that you guys do. I try to write you notes and just express, you know, that this is such a fulfilling thing for me to do. But I've got to make my life work financially too. And so when you donate, it just makes it makes me feel like I can make a living, at least contribute a good part to my living doing this thing that I love and appreciate the opportunity to do so much. So thank you for all your support you give, and if you're prompted to give some more, thank you very much. I'd love it.
If you double your donation, you'll double your blessings.
Ooh, I wish I could live within that story. Not quite that way, but I do. There's just such an openness that just you know is there as I interact with people in all sorts of ways, and I don't know. I feel really connected to this audience, and I'm grateful for that. So,
well, I believe that was from Mr. Miyagi. Double your donation, double your blessings. I think that's straight out of Crockett.
Man, I'm going to have to rewatch Karate Kid.
Everybody anyway, go home and watch it again and make a donation.
That's right. I'll link to it. Anyway, thanks, guys. Good night. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. And
as well.